Oh, that was a nice change. Ideally, if we practiced what we have been preaching for the past few weeks, we could now come from wherever we have been practicing and feel, see, think universally. So maybe if anybody has done their homework, you can share with us what that would be like. What would it be like for us to now explore the philosophy of evolution from a consciousness of universality? What do you think it would be like?
We could probably see the whole picture, past, present, future, and every level of development simultaneously.
Any other idea?
We would live totally in the present.
Okay. Think about this term, universality. To see and feel and think universally. What would we be seeing, feeling and thinking?
And look at this, the steps of evolution, or we would see all the reason behind the necessity, what came out and how it all fits in the whole structure again.
The reason behind and the necessity of for how it all came out. Okay, this is a popular idea in Enlightenment philosophy, to see the reason behind everything, otherwise known as spirit, the ultimate reason. Sigurd, you have an idea? Sigurd? And if you were seeing everything in everything, how would it feel?
One. To feel part of it.
What would be the sensation?
Sensation.
Like you're not there anymore. Yeah.
Maybe.
So you think that for you it means to disappear? Okay.
A song, a sound. Rock.
Yeah.
Sound.
Think about the term universal. Universals. What are universals? And how do they look and feel?
There's no center point left.
They pertain to everything.
Give me an example.
Consciousness. Consciousness as a thing, not mine or yours.
But if consciousness as a thing, is it in this?
Maybe, but in the level I don't understand. Or is we put it...
Because universal would mean to feel and see something which is undoubtedly, perceptibly, in everything.
I have an example. Last old choir member brought in a tuning fork, and then every person clicked the tuning fork and did his tone. So we experienced that every ohm did an ohm. So every ohm was different, but underneath was like a
A harmonic.
Harmonizing structure. Yeah. I think that was a very striking.
So you think that you can transfer that analogy to the question which I'm asking?
Yes, that is.
And that if you were perceiving something universal, you would hear a harmonic tone.
Yeah, but a difference in everything and even underlying a bondage or something, I don't know how to express it. But
yeah, somehow all the differences would give you a harmonic.
No. It was underneath was a flowing tone, and on this everything expressed his own.
So what would that underlying tone
be? Oneness, I would say.
So you would have a perception of oneness.
And individuality. Both.
And how would that, wait a minute, Margaret, how would that feel?
Amazing. He felt alone.
Wait, what kind of a sense?
It was destroyed to explore.
What kind of a sensation would it give you?
Oh. And stillness. Quiet.
Stillness. You want to say something?
I think I would not be able to distinguish. I would not be thinking at that moment. I would feel like crying, maybe. And just the distinction at that point, I think my mind would disappear at that point.
I think nobody can talk about it because nobody has experienced in the whole practice.
No, but we need to use our imaginations a little bit.
That which has been, that which is, and that which will be is inevitable.
So is anyone here familiar with Platonic philosophy?
Yeah.
So according to Plato, which everybody from the West at least should know, there is something that is universal in existence called the good, and something else called the true, and something else called the beautiful. And Sri Aurobindo copies this formula in all of his books. And in these chapters that we've been reading, he has used this formula two or three times. He has said that a universal consciousness, a consciousness of universality, would perceive in everything the good, the true, and the beautiful.
This is the present moment. Without thinking, without soul, total unity.
So what I have referred to as the Buddhistic reduction, stepping back from the ego and the sensation and the forms that we anticipate and our dogmas and our opinions and our impressions, and stepping back from all of those things into pure existence, and then elevating ourselves slightly even into what Sri Aurobindo calls a higher mind thought, where thought is not abstract thought, but it is the thought nature of reality, because this universe is made up of different planes and they're not separated according to this metaphysical understanding. So we could detach ourselves from our normal human pattern of thinking and feeling and elevate ourselves by an act of will, buddhi, and perceive universal thought forms in things. For example, beauty in the forest. But not that we think the forest is beautiful, but perceiving the beauty in that multiplicity of living entities that are processing information in relation to the environment and us. So it is possible to enter into a forest in a state of silence and detachment and to perceive beauty. We used an example earlier of the possibility of perceiving the spirit of healing and feeling a will, that will which is universal, which is manifesting in minds and bodies and all over the world all the time, to help others get better, to recover from their maladies. There is a vast human energy focused on healing all the time. And this is not an abstraction. This is a reality which can be perceived. You can tune in to that spirit of healing. And then you can treat your plants, your friends, yourself, your clients, from that energy perspective of the spirit of healing, instead of in some personal, narrow, pragmatic, or judgmental, or even purposeful, but less universally purposeful way.
You have been asked what calls it Akashic Field. And in ancient times, the Indian called it Akashic Chronicle.
So one of the reasons why I have felt a few times during these weeks that you and I were arguing a little bit about some concepts is because I have been trying to push the focus, even though Sri Aurobindo's words were on the screen, I've been trying to indicate that it's not Sri Aurobindo's words which mean anything. And it's not because he said those words that I'm putting them on the screen. But it's possible to do the things which he's speaking about, to alter our perceptions by an act of will. And that's called yoga. And it's supposed to be the reason why we are here in this place. So if we actually practice this Buddhistic reduction and deliberately throughout the day teach ourselves to perceive, not to think, but to perceive universals, we can alter our consciousness. Sri Aurobindo has given us a guarantee. He says the first step is liberation from thoughts, sensations, perceptions, opinions, desires, dogmas. Put all of that at a remove from one's energetic and allow oneself to perceive universals. And then that makes an opening to the descent of a vibrational, energetic consciousness that he says is not just cognition, it is also power. It is a different power, a different way to move things in the world, a different way to achieve things, a different way to relate to things that is not human. But it's there in the atmosphere waiting for an opening. And then the whole energy of oneself shifts. It shifts into emptiness, silence, and speed, rapidity, swiftness, accuracy. It eliminates waste because one is not blocking the flow either in or out, because one is universalized, and it makes the body's cells more subtle, and the experience of flow is there. The experience, the mother describes this as a rhythm, the experience of a rhythm in everything. It's not a personal thing, and there are no boundaries between people. If we're experiencing a rhythm in everything, it's in each of us. If we're experiencing an energy of love, another one of those universals, if we tune into that, then it's not you and me and her and him and whatever, it's just that.
The question is, it we experience it or we are it?
Yeah, you can't. You experience it because you are it.
But in the world, experience as peril, danger. So I would rather say we are.
Well, we are whether we experience it or not.
If you experience it as an I or not, which experiences it?
No, but no. The I is always there, and the you, the thou, is always there. But the transparency is not always there. And so you think of these as separate, and you think of experience as being separate from what you are. And that's a mistake, fundamentally. So Sri Aurobindo says, when we live in the Spirit, when we live in the Spirit, and here he means spirit in a very concrete way. When we live in the all-creative divine force. For him, spirit is not something abstract. When we live in the all-creative energy of divine creativity, then we not only know, but are this truth of our being. The individual then enjoys in the Spirit. So you still enjoy everything, but you enjoy it from a center of universal perception that is impersonal and powerful. So, if we practiced that, which Sri Aurobindo strongly recommends that we do, if we practice that constantly, he says, then we have the possibility of experiencing a descent of higher planes of consciousness into the life and body. Then, if we were looking at the question of evolution, and this is what I've been asking us to do from the beginning, to try to put our consciousness directly into contact with whatever it is that we call evolution, to stop thinking about it and theorizing about it. At some point, after assembling all the tools to tune in to something called evolution, which we presume is a universal movement of nature that has been ongoing for some billions of years and is not discontinuous at any point. Even Darwin tells us that this power of nature to unendingly diversify itself and to speciate in a way that appears to be very successful. So therefore, purposeful, at least with respect to surviving and replicating and creating habitats and influencing habitats and having habitats influence behavior and having behavior be incorporated into life patterns that then get selected genetically, because the way selection works is in relation to the environment, and it's not random at all. It's never been random, and most evolutionary theorists never thought it was random. Certainly Darwin didn't think it was random. He thought it was environmentally determined. So that's what everybody thinks these days. And so there is this power in nature that has been there, according to Sri Aurobindo, since the Divine Mother decided to pour life into matter. We don't know the actual historical moment that occurred, but I'm going to put some pictures on the board in a minute that might give us some idea about that.
Something just interesting appeared in the media, and that is that evolution can only go forward. There's never been any sign of reverse
Absolutely.
Mutation,
yeah.
And so on. And nothing has ever returned to what had been, what had one time been.
Yeah, Dawkins has created a beautiful argument for the inevitability of evolution going forward, and Dennett has reiterated it in his books. And it's a law of physics, actually. So, if we perceive nature as this ever-moving energy of forward diversification in response to environmental constraints, and those environmental constraints exist in the organism as well as outside of the organism, then we might perceive something universal called adaptivity. The ongoing adaptivity of life to its environment. The mutual accommodation of energy fields on the Earth, in the biosphere. The biosphere is made up of a complex web of mutually accommodating energies. If we perceived that universal nature, Sri Aurobindo calls it, if we perceived universal nature, then we would be doing what he recommends. We are it. Those animals are it. Those trees are it. And every bit of decay and consumption and enjoyment and death and birth and energy exchange, which is going on around us all the time, in our bodies and outside, all of that is a continuous field of energy exchange called nature. So instead of perceiving ourselves as separate entities, Sri Aurobindo says, we can become conscious of ourselves as part of that whole field and lose completely the sense of being a separate ego. It requires something called sacrifice. And apparently, the Supreme has done that deliberately as an example. All of existence has come about because of that sacrifice. By denying itself, it became everything. That's the metaphysics of Sri Aurobindo's yoga. His yoga philosophy is based upon that. So in order to get back to the divine oneness, we must sacrifice in the way that Purusha sacrificed in the beginning. And that's what Vladimir is always reading in the Vedas to us. And it's what Savitri is always saying and doing. So, my question is, how would evolution look if we did that? If we looked at it, listened to it, saw it, felt it, as this field of energy that is continuous and has been continuous for some billions of years and is absolutely not discontinuous at any point. Bergson tells us that this is the nature of intuitive consciousness and that it has as a part of it a complete shift in our perception of time. We no longer perceive time as moments, but we perceive time as a continuum of intensities. So, if we were thinking like that, and we look back at just human evolution, we've decided a few times here that one of the primary fundamental human behaviors that constitutes human life and society from the very beginning, as far as we can tell, is ethical behavior. The human being is able to sacrifice on an individual and a collective level some immediate gains for other considerations that it believes will be beneficial, that other activities that it believes will be beneficial. And the nature of human society is that it organizes its energy, it sacrifices some of its immediate rewards and pleasures for the sake of a more general well-being of the group. This is the nature of human society. So we can look at, if we look at human evolution from, this is just human evolution, in a little while we'll go back to animal and other evolution, but this is a developmental psychological model of societies. And it says that sometime in the distant past, there was an archaic consciousness that was pretty close to nature, from which there don't appear to be any historical remains, but we can imagine that early human civilization was very close to the animal and language was very rudimentary, and there was a kind of perception, but that perception was not characterized, for example, by perspective. It was not a linear perception. It was more of a perception of the point being the whole. And then there came about a kind of tribal society that we do have remains from, that seems to be very organized, centrally organized around a magical and ritualistic consciousness that enabled particularly the shaman, but people in general, to read nature in a very intimate way and to perform certain kinds of deliberate rhythmical patterns that would influence the outcome of actions. And these rhythmic patterns of language and dance and painting and so on helped the society survive.
Maybe so the Quran from the Tamil language.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. Then we can think about another level of human society that we know of that's characterized more by a belief in God-kings, belief in the ability of the gods to manifest in great men and women who create a hierarchy of order, and there's a spirit of devotion and worship that grows up under the dictates of this divine ruler. And then, you know, there's undoubtedly a kind of hierarchy in all of these situations, but this is where hierarchy becomes more clearly defined. And individual human beings are selecting behavior patterns that are pretty much sure to guarantee the survival of the class, a class of people, in relation to another class of people. So here behavior becomes really important. At the lower level, behavior is important, but it's not classified, it's not highly regulated, it's more spontaneous behavior. There's a book I'm working on, it's called The Four Dimensions of Evolution, Genetic, Epigenetic, Behavioral, and Symbolic, and how these are interrelated. And it's pretty widely recognized today by evolutionary biologists that although the laws of genetics are understood, and the genetic substructure of life is what carries whatever it carries, it always depends upon development in the environment, and the environment determines what's triggered and what's not triggered in the genome. So the genome has a certain plasticity, and under some circumstances it manifests certain patterns and colors and shapes and qualities, and under other circumstances it manifests other patterns. So genetics are not, strictly speaking, the determinant of the forms of life, the phenotype. The phenotype is determined by the environment to a very large extent, although the lion can't become a giraffe just because it eats the giraffe. It is definitely constrained by its genetic structure, but the lion does have the choice to live in the swamp or on the mountain or on the plains, or, you know, depending upon circumstances, there's a flexibility there. And lower species are much more flexible, and they can even change their colors and change their shapes and whatever in response to the environment. So then, in human society, and also as we learn from Conrad Lorenz, in many animal societies, behavior patterns determine whether the species survives or not. It's not just responding to the environment, but it's actually practicing a ritual. Bees do it, bats do it, and monkeys do it, and probably everybody does it to some extent. There are patterns of behavior that determine whether this group is going to be more successful or whether that group is going to be more successful. So we'll see the shrew a little bit later, and we'll find out that shrews were very early mammals that were very adaptive. Shrews could live in swamps, they could live in trees, they could live in holes, they could live in all kinds of circumstances, and they were able to evade dinosaurs, and they eventually evolved into hippos and pigs and monkeys and everything else. So some of the shrews have long noses, some have short noses, some have long fur, and some have, you know, they adapted horizontally in many different ways, but eventually they formed the platform for the efflorescence of all mammals, just about, that have, you know, the primate, that lead towards primate evolution. So behavior is very important. If the shrew decides to live in the trees, because that's where the fruit is, then before maybe it lived in the river or in a hole in the ground, and it had different, it manifested different phenotypic structures. But the more it lives in the trees, the more its offspring are selected on the basis of those that can survive best in the trees, those that have stronger grip. It's more important than those that have a long nose that have to dig into the ground. And so the way genetics works is that those survive who have that tree-clinging quality as a result of their genetic structure, and those who don't have that fall out of the tree and get eaten by the snake. So eventually you have a whole breed or subspecies of shrew that's known as the tree shrew. And you put it beside a river shrew and they don't look the same anymore after some millions of years. So the grasping capacity is triggered by the environment, if it's there at all, and probably it is. And then by repeating that behavior, the species selects by its behavior those that are best at living in that environment. And so Darwinian selection works like that. Maybe some shrew gets wings and flies off to the next forest and becomes a bird, who knows. Then, when we get to this, when we get into these levels, this kicks in. And some animals have this too, which we've read about in Lawrence. The symbolic behavior becomes more important to survival than the physical and vital behavior. And when language comes into play, then our evolution becomes strictly a function of communication. So we decide what it's best to do. You know, the storm is coming, we put up the shutters, we go into the basement, and we survive the storm because we got the broadcast over the television that that's what we needed to do. And so human society has been extremely successful in a short period of, relatively short period of time. It has diversified enormously and filled up every niche because of this ability. So in mythical societies, let's say Egyptian society, what would be a typical structural modification in Egyptian society that would ensure its longevity for 5,000 years? What would be a structural adaptation? You know, if you think about Middle Eastern society and North African society and emergence from the Neolithic times, what kind of structural adaptation do you associate with Egyptian, the longevity of Egyptian society?
A hierarchy.
Okay, what else? That's in governance. Now besides governance, what else could you think of?
Religion. The top of governance, okay, is a god, and so there's a connection between,
okay, so let's
the hierarchy.
Okay, we've got hierarchy in religion. Now what other adaptation do you associate with Egyptian success?
You mean physical longevity?
Whatever, any adaptation.
I believe the pyramid gives you
The pyramid of structure, you think it helped them to survive?
This it keeps you young.
Or is it just a symbolic...
water, Nile.
Okay. River farming, delta farming.
The word happy goes back to help the Nile God.
So, some... You can imagine this group of people evolving from this magical stage into river delta communities that were very successful because of their breeding of crops, grains, and animals that grew around the river. And they became very rich and powerful. And they also happened to have a class structure that was based upon mathematics. They had a really keen mathematical mind that enabled them to design pyramids, to understand stars, the movements of celestial bodies.
Yes. Anybody in this here?
Yes, UBS collection.
You can turn on that now. I can use it.
Don't need light. We concentrate on our views.
Well, I want to show you some pictures now.
No, that's not.
If you don't have our light,
if you need them, I have them. You can just move. Torch. Only have to move. If you move to more light, you can move. Yeah?
Okay. I'm just going to wipe this off now. So just think a little bit about this mythic structure has some things which happen on the structural level and some things which happen on the level of form. For example, the myth, I would say, would be a formal structure. The myth of the recycling of Horus and the sun that sets and becomes, renews itself immortally, and that whole mythology supports the pattern of living that those people adopted. So mythical form and hierarchic structure and agriculture and powerful hierarchic leadership, all of those things developed together in that human group in a way that was very successful. They survived for a long time. And then this religious and moralistic development, if you can have your light back, is
structure and form different?
That's a good question. Vladimir is always talking to us about the structure of language, mm-hmm. all of its elements. Scientists often talk to us about genetic structure. But the language works to communicate. And so the way we use it to communicate is different from all the elements that make it up. So that's, in Aristotelian thought, the form is the way the thing is. And the structure is all of the changes that come about all the time for the thing to be what it is.
Process.
So, structure and process are very, very similar. So in physics, there's this idea that forms are maintained by the dissipation of energy. Living forms are maintain themselves by the dissipation of energy. We keep consuming energy, but we keep staying what we are. And so that's the structure. The dissipation of energy is the physical structure that maintains the form, the species. So then, you know, the religious we can associate more with medieval society, both Indian and Western medieval society, where you have the church and the priesthood and
Judaism before that.
Yeah, and then we have our society, which has its, you know, it has capitalism and socialism and democracy, which all three of which have the purpose of helping our societies to continue themselves and to distribute wealth equally, more or less, among people, so that people help each other survive. So democracy, socialism, and communism are all social structures that come from this period where pretty much everybody is willing to make sacrifices for the sake of the social group, under one form of government or the other. But it's not because of some presumed authority, and it's not because of some divine right. It's really for the sake of the well-being of everyone that we adopt democracy or socialism or communism. It may not work like that, but that's the reason that we do it. The theorists of government are trying to find a system that works well for everyone. And then Sri Aurobindo suggests that if we rise into that other more universal consciousness and have a new kind of energy that flows in humanity, that we will have new structures, new bodies, new social structures, new forms of new expressions of language and understanding that are determined by this universalization of consciousness, which is unlimited in its energy of expression. We can't do that under our present circumstances except within a fairly narrow bandwidth, because our biological structures have evolved from this animal base, and even though, especially with longevity and medicine and exercise and diet and all those things that we do for the sake of our well-being have had effects on the human species, it still hasn't become free from the constraints of aging and so on. But according to Sri Aurobindo and another, once we enter into this stage, we can actually deal with some of those more fundamental constraints. So fundamental constraints have been there all along, environmental constraints and human and biological and historical constraints have been there all along. And yet, if you think about what's happened in human societies all over the world, there's an incredible diversity and resilience that has come through each of these stages. And each of these stages has produced art, and each has produced techniques for civilization, and each has produced patterns of relationships between communities that are amazing. So one of the things we can perceive in a perspective like this of society, the evolution of society as we know it, is a certain principle of diversification of life, the energy, the life force that diversifies itself through human communities. The life force that diversifies itself through human communities is the same life force that diversifies itself through animal species throughout the history of evolution. It's just one continuous driving energy of consciousness that is diversifying its forms of expression and its structural adaptations. If we stop looking at the structural adaptations or at the forms and try to perceive that universal life force that is driving in all of those, that is constantly diversifying and creating marvelous structures and forms, then we may be perceiving something spiritual, something really true and divine. Because the divine is not in any of those structures or any of those forms. The divine is an infinite energy of beauty and power and delight that in itself has no manifestation, but that is the essential driving force in everything that exists, according to Sri Aurobindo's metaphysical philosophy of evolution. And he says, we can learn to perceive that, capital T, in things. And it allows us to know more accurately, more completely, more truly, what the nature of things is. So, not just the divine in things, but the nature of things is better known by that consciousness than by the rational and scientific, or by the religious, or by the mythical, or by the magical, or by the archaic. This has not yet evolved. And it's not just cognition, it is an energy, a creative energy of being that grasps things in their totality, not cognitively, but energetically, and influences the evolution of things by its resonance, by its rhythms of expression and being and understanding that are holistic. Now, if we adopt that standpoint, then we do something that philosophy has so far not achieved. Philosophy, as we have heard from Bergson and others, first of all went through a period of believing that all the forms that we perceive are eternal. Elephant is eternal, human society is eternal, evolution, the way we understand it, is eternal. All these forms of understanding, physics, the laws of physics, these are all eternal truths. We are human beings, the human being is an eternal truth. The behavior of animals is an eternal truth. So then philosophy thought, as the Sfota thought, that the generalities of things are the truth of things. Then we found out that the generalities of things aren't the truth of things at all, that we have new laws of physics that are being discovered all the time, species are becoming extinct all the time, nothing is permanent, nothing is known absolutely, and everything has always been constantly changing. And this idea that we have of eternal forms is a product of the mind. They are concepts. That's what the rational mind figures out, finally. These are just concepts. We like to believe that they're eternal because that sort of sounds true. And we don't see things disappearing in front of our eyes all the time, so they seem to be eternal truths. So democracy is an eternal principle of human behavior and government, and Before that, it was the church, which is the eternal word of God, and before that, it was the mountain out there where all the magic forces reside. And nobody knew that that mountain turned up just in the last few hundred million years, and someday it's going to erode. So we can see how the scientific mind finally learned that the forms that it perceives are not eternal. They are concepts that are reinforced by repeated perceptions. Then, how do I get this thing to give me...
Close full screen.
Document. Okay, paleo life. Let me enlarge this. View. Full screen. So if we look at a chart of evolutionary life, we see that 400 million years ago, during the Devonian Age, the first amphibians appeared on Earth. And the main life form that was there at that time was a conical, shell-like being. And this conical shell-like being, called a conodont, existed all over the Earth. And there was a major extinction that occurred at the end of the Devonian, and all those conodonts disappeared. Some of those amphibians survived, and the first reptiles appeared during this Carboniferous age. And in the Permian, 250 to 300 million years ago, there was a great explosion of reptilian life. And then there was a major extinction at the end of the Permian, and 90% of life was extinguished. 90%. But these little guys, these are not to size, this is a shrew, and this is a dinosaur. And these guys were left over from this Permian extinction. Very small mammals and very big reptiles survived the Permian extinction. And then came the Jurassic, and you know that there the dinosaurs exploded. So during this period between in the Devonian, right before the Permian, there was a guy here who was a small precursor of dinosaurs. He was a structure. Science looks at this guy as a certain kind of structural beginning of quadrupedal life. He was like a fish, but he could walk on the land, and these things sticking out on the top there helped to control temperature variations in his little body. There were lots of these guys living in the Devonian, and they somehow survived the mass extinction, and they became dinosaurs. I'll show you some of them. They got a little bit bigger. They became these guys. But these guys are still not proper dinosaurs. These guys have hollow bones, they lay eggs, and they're more like birds than dinosaurs, but they were closely related to that little fellow with the sale. At that time, we learned only in the 1960s, at that time, all of these species were spread all over the earth because the earth was one body of land. This was called the Great Ocean. I mean, this has been called the Great Ocean Phantalasa. And this was what's now called Pangaea, Pangaea. The earth body, the earth formations of the land were continuous. And so these, whatever life forms evolved at that time, easily spread everywhere before the land masses separated. And then the Darwinian thing kicks in. Once the land masses separate, then you have isolation. So this just shows you the extinctions. During the Permian, all of these guys became extinct. During the Devonian, all those little shell guys became extinct at the end of the Devonian. Then, during the Triassic, these guys became extinct. But the Ammonoids, although they became extinct, some of them evolved into this kind of ammonoid. Some of the marine reptiles evolved into some other kinds of marine reptiles. But for the most part, everything became extinct during that period. And that opened the door for the few who survived to make the most of the environment, and they proliferated. And so dinosaurs proliferated during this period, although the shrews were there. And then when they became extinct, the shrews proliferated. You'll notice that this guy was, this guy's compared to a little shrew-like creature here. And he probably pecked the ground like a bird and ate up as many of those shrews as he could manage. But some of them lived in holes in the ground and some lived in rivers, and they were very adaptable creatures. So then, during that Permian period, we had a shift in the continents of the Earth. Laurasia started moving in the direction of Asia, and South America and North America started to split. And finally, in the Triassic, these three land masses, South America, North America, and Eurasia, separated completely. And during that transition from the Devonian to the Triassic and the Jurassic, mammals, well, this is a kind of fish that migrated onto the land and became this guy. And, you know, this structurally, this guy looks like he could be a dog, but in fact he was a lizard. And this lizard eventually became this shrew within just a few million years. There's a very close relationship between that guy and this guy. And then this guy started to diversify a lot and became creatures like this. And creatures like this then became primates. So we're talking about a period of time of quadrupedal evolution that starts with this sort of bird-like lizard. And this period in the Earth was, so between 400 million and 150 million years, in the whole scheme of things, very rapid evolutionary diversification, because life had begun 3 billion years before. This is just in the last 400 million years. And after each of these extinctions, there was a big fluorescence of new species. And then at the end of that extinction, another efflorescence of new species that are not here. This is just showing the ones that became extinct. If we think about evolution as a radiation of diverse species within a certain range or parameter, within certain parameters of limitation, we can understand evolution diversifying horizontally. But at each major extinction, and at also at other times, there is a vertical evolution that takes place, which produces better adaptations, until finally, as a result of massive diversification on the horizontal plane and incremental diversification on a horizontal plane, there are from time to time major leaps vertically that produce a range of adaptations that are better adapted, even though the environment eventually wipes them out. Until we get, I mean, here we understand these late versions of the shrew, known as hippos and cats, and finally this guy who has adapted mainly symbolically to every niche on the surface of the earth and has incorporated into his genome the major cognitive processes, the citta and the manas and the buddhi, that have been worked out incrementally through all of these massive periods of time, millions of years, hundreds of millions of years, during which the cellular organic structure in relation to the terrestrial environment has evolved more and more complex structures of adaptation and forms of expression. So it's possible to perceive in nature a driving force of creativity and adaptation that, as Sri Aurobindo says, is interested in infinite, expressing an infinite power of diversification of form within the constraints of consuming, aging, reproducing, conquering, mastering an environment. You know, by the process of mastering an environment and maintaining a type for a certain period of time until it's necessary for that type to further diversify itself in ways that are necessary for it to continue happening under environmental conditions. This power of nature to endlessly diversify itself under the conditions of a material environment does not imply that any of those structures and forms pre-existed on a spiritual plane. What it implies is that the spirit itself continued to exist through all of those structures and forms of expression. And so metaphysically, what we can learn, that Bergson and Sri Aurobindo are encouraging us to learn, is that the structures and the forms are not what is immortal and infinite and spiritual. What is immortal and infinite and spiritual is essential being, self. And that self is characterized by the four powers of the Divine Mother. The Divine is infinite power, infinite beauty, infinite truth, and infinite perfectibility, variability, expression in detail, detailed expression. So all you really need to understand how evolution has occurred is, on the one hand, that spirit of infinite truth, beauty, power, and delight in detailed expression, and on the other hand, the constraints of the earth, of the material habitat. The constraints of the material habitat, the constraints that produce structure, are the constraints of matter, the constraints of energy exchange between elements, the constraints of habitat, temperature, the constraints of tolerance between species, adaptability, all the constraints of nature are known now scientifically. But what is not known scientifically is how the machine keeps running in spite of everything and keeps finding new forms of expression within clearly defined limits. There are about five different body plans in all of nature. There are constraints within the temperate environment. There's some temperatures beyond which life cannot continue, and at the upper level and at the lower level. So all of these constraints are known. The availability of food in the environment at any particular time, the availability of oxygen and water, and all of those constraints are known. And adaptation is known, the processes of adaptation, the processes of genetic transfer and mutation and recombination, that's known. The processes of epigenetic development under different conditions are known. The processes of behavioral patterns which give delight, habits that allow species or communities to stay in one place for as long as possible because it works there and they enjoy it. These behavioral patterns are known. The symbolic patterns of communication based upon all those lower structures which enable us to calculate, predict, plan, express, the sort of what was in linguistics was defined as the certain finite number of relationships, causal relationships, and spatial relationships, and relationships of succession. These are the constraints. All structurally and formally understood. The question that remains is, where does it come from and where is it going? Only Sri Aurobindo so far has elaborated a system of understanding that puts together the metaphysical, psychological dimension with the structural and the formal. And all the scientists are either going for structure or form. All the philosophers are going for either structure or form. One we know empirically, the other we know abstractly as a result of generalization. So generalization characterizes everything. structural mechanism characterizes everything, but the relationship between those, between the conceptual general form of things and the structural supports is a mystery. It continues to be a mystery. The relationship between the genome and the phenome, and between our perception and analysis and what we know, these continue to be mysteries. So that Sri Aurobindo says our life is a paradox with God for key, but he doesn't mean a God outside that is magically combining everything like Berkeley thought. He means the essential nature of all of the structures and forms, which is itself the self. And the only thing that can happen on earth is what is possible to the self under the constraints of the material environment. So when we look at the material environment on the one hand, inside or outside, and we look at its form, its meaning, on the other hand, they are the same thing. The only thing that the self can be is what it is. And it is infinite structure, structural variation, and formal variation at the same time. So mind tends to latch on to the forms of things and think that it knows something. But then the structures keep changing and don't have a clear relationship to what we know. And so philosophy, finally, in the 20th century, with Bergson and Sri Aurobindo and Whitehead and a few others, says, mind works like this. It analyzes structures and it concludes on the basis of general patterns, form, the formal understanding of things. But it's incapable of identifying itself with the things themselves. So it knows the structures abstractly, it knows the forms abstractly, but it doesn't know anything directly. So that next level of evolution, which is also a new power of evolution, knows form and structure in their unity, and also each individual as a variation of the same, and each process as a variation of the same. And it doesn't know that abstractly, it knows it energetically. It is that totality. And then we have truth consciousness. That's Sri Aurobindo's concept of the origin and end of the processes of nature.
How for quite a few million years you had the quadruplets. What was that process of bringing, you know, man, bringing him into an erect position? Was there, for instance, something, as you said, what are the parameters which keep the process going? Was there something like an influx in relationship now to the change or possible change of the new evolutionary force? Is that also an influx? What were the spirits of mass extinction?
I don't know.
In this new
but
moment.
Theoretically, the influx is ever present. It never stops. And the variation and adaptation also never stops.
It's different intensities. So.
Different intensities and different circumstances. And the only thing that can happen is what is.
So, could you define, for instance, in your drawing, how mind came in? You have life is coming into mental mind.
No, I can't, and I don't think it's necessary to do that, because mind didn't come in any time except when it all came in. Mind is always there. Mind and spirit and matter, mind and life, it's one thing with different levels of vibration.
So the possibility of unity of supermind is also always
there. It's always there. But it hasn't found yet a relationship between its potential and its actual. You know, the essential Aristotelian perception is true. There is a potential of things, and there is the actual thing that they become. Some things haven't become their actual potential yet.
Because I think that's, I don't know if that's a nobility trip in this approach to speak about the descent. I mean, in all of that, it looks like it's a movement, it's coming from within, or it's unfolding from above or below, but there's a this specific thing which he emphasizes on the descent of the new evolutionary force. It's actually coming from above.
Coming from above? Above what? As the mother would say. Above what? Above the cosmos? Above the earth? Above your head? From above what exactly is it coming?
But they do talk about the descent going like that, no?
That's on the human personal yogic level.
Yeah.
There is a concept of a descent of higher consciousness into the mind and life and body, which you contact by a yogic process of ascent and bring that down. But he's asking a question about life, mind, body, the whole evolutionary nature. Well, Sri Aurobindo, I believe, says it's not just body, life, mind. It's, there are two hemispheres. There's this hemisphere that we know about, and there's that other hemisphere, which is all the subtle planes of divine consciousness. And they're constantly all there, interacting.
It's one sphere, the two hemispheres.
So this lower one has to be ready for that higher one to really manifest in forms and structures. But because that both are there, they're constantly communicating with each other. So the gods who are in the overmind plane are constantly stimulating the naiads and the dyads to romp in the forest so that the birds have some joy in reproducing. So all of these subtle and gross planes are constantly interacting, if we could but see them, according to those who say they do see them.
One can just say, okay, spirit playing around in all of these little forms, come, and the last chart was this human form. But that could be wiped out, and then some other new form of complete. But the yoga is done in the body. And in the body, I expect that's in this kind of something like this, is how we reach the yoga, we bring the yoga.
Yes.
And then at this point, maybe this body is not necessary, then that energy then makes that new chart, and we don't know about that.
Yeah. So Sri Aurobindo left the question open, whether the human being will be capable of transforming itself and being a link to the next species. He left that open. And he says in the Book of Everlasting Day that whether the human being does that or not, the new species will find a way to manifest.
So it doesn't mean the human needs form.
No.
The species will be man in the next
Sri Aurobindo
leaves.
Sri Aurobindo leaves the question open as to what the new species will be.
So Superman could be born.
What form it will take.
But then you say the link between the new species. That means there will be a species in between man and Superman?
I don't know. Theoretically, Superman is the link between. But
between what?
Between the human and the supramental
world.
Supramental species.
I thought Superman is a supramental species.
No.
Oh, but
you didn't do your homework.
Not.
You haven't done your homework. The last thing that Sri Aurobindo wrote was a series of essays called The Supramental Manifestation. And he wrote it in 47, 48, 49. And the last two or three chapters, called The Mind of Light, are about the Superman. And this is before anything supramental manifests. So his indication is that the supramental being, when it manifests, is a result of spiritual energies that are at least partially created by us in the process of rebirth, of death and rebirth. The yogi learns to purify the sheaths and make a conscious departure and a conscious re-entry into manifestation, and in that interlude consciously synthesizes all of the potentials that are present at that moment in cosmic time and space, and brings into manifestation new potentialities. But whether those new potentialities constitute a new human being who progresses towards the supramental, he leaves open. He says it's possible, but it's also possible that that new being manifests directly as a result of those energies of reincarnation.
But there is a only solution to all of this. There is no one way. In the book of George van Spelgen, of a man, there is a lot of answers to the question how it may happen, what is first in the sixth chapters of our window manifestation are analyzed, and it appears that both the gradual evolution of a man as it is now approaching of a man and Superman slowly, and also there's maybe a descent. And Sri Aurobindo said that he will be first to manifest in a spiritual body.
But it doesn't have to be a human body.
Of course, not human, as we know it today.
And it doesn't have to be him per se.
Of course.
It's that supramental consciousness, yes, which he was channeling.
Yeah, the problem is that we have a stage and behind the curtain things going on. So we are in the first row of the spectators and we are waiting for appearance. But
yeah,
the problem is behind.
Yeah, right. So there, I mean, yogis, he refers to the great ones, capital T, capital G, capital O, in the synthesis of yoga. The great ones who work behind the screen. And they are the yogis who become conscious of these processes and remain conscious outside of the body. So who are they, where are they, and what do they have to do with all of this, we can't imagine. But he says that we can transform our consciousness into a spiritual consciousness that perceives universally and allows those energies to come into the earth field.
But there's one question which I also would like to address in a sense, because during the whole weeks of your presentation, you, how to say, you leave unanswered one question about why we are here.
Only one, huh?
psychic soul,
yes,
which is emulation of divine, which is inside us. So this approach.
I'm trying to discourage the dogmatic approach.
Of course, me too.
Because I would like for us to discover something. And one of the main blockages to discovery is the mythic consciousness. And the mythic consciousness loves to take dogma and make out of it a final answer to everything and to not move at all from its present position. And then it becomes a religious consciousness. And, you know, then it becomes an accepted dogma. First it's a mythic consciousness, and then it becomes a dogma, and then everybody is in the same box that human beings have always been in. So if we don't try to break that pattern definitively, we will just replicate the old species in a new form. And that old species has been replicating itself in new forms very successfully for a few thousand years, and it would undoubtedly love to keep on doing it.
You mean reptiles? The theory that reptiles are in a new form. In US, we are watching
rabbit brain.
I have a question.
It's time for us to go.
Do you think some of these intermediary beings, are there an indication that they are, some of them are around?
It doesn't matter what I think.
No, it's not. Is there any indication
and
that
I,
whether it's your
It doesn't matter what I think.
Taking the risk of being dogmatic. When did this psychic being come in? In a function?
It's always there.
No idea.
Okay, is it the essence which is there?
I don't know, yes?
I want to say to the transition phase, the mother said in 1st January 1969, the consciousness of the Superman descended.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, man with the consciousness of the Superman is the transition phase towards the Superman.
Possibly.
So this consciousness is working on the transformation of man into the reality.
Okay, this was in her consciousness. She was speaking about what happened in her consciousness.
She said that consciousness objectively descended, and she said it was roaming all over the earth to search for people who had
But look, that's the way she experienced it. And throughout Sri Aurobindo's writings and the mother's writings, they are always clearly expressing the way they are perceiving the process themselves. And they always generalize it to the earth as a whole. But and the Buddha did that too. He said if one person gets liberation, everyone gets liberation. But he didn't really mean that everyone gets liberation. So the Superman consciousness has manifested on the earth in the mother's vehicle. And she is active on the earth in her subtle body. But that doesn't mean that there are any other human beings who are participating very actively in that process.
I don't think like it. Because the mother said,
I hope there are.
Let us find the people who are collaborating.
So
and
this
she
is.
She asked it, who is we?
Yeah.
And she said, you and I, the consciousness. And then it started rolling
right
around the world.
So this is, okay, this is the myth of Savitri. This is exactly what Savitri does, and we just read it on Wednesday night. The force of transformation, the goddess of luminous consciousness and speech, is sent out upon earth to find the ready person.
Always.
Now, for us to jump to the conclusion that that's happening all over the place all the time just because that Savitri's mission is to reify the myth, to take the myth as a statement of fact. And there's a strong tendency in the human being to do that. But if we perceive it, if we are participating in it, if we know it directly as a result of the evolution of our consciousness in the practice of yoga, then we can know it, for really know it. And then it makes an evolutionary difference. But as long as we just believe it...
We are here for that, to experience it. He said she found it out of it for that to be the cradle of Superman. That means the cradle of...
Yes, but here, this is exactly the mistake. Because she created Auroville for that, therefore, that is what Auroville is.
Should be.
So, there's a big gap between what she created it for and what it actually is.
We are not aspiring enough.
We have just crossed the boundary from philosophy to religion.
Actually, there's a double meaning of both, because on one hand, religion is conceived till now was ruled by gods, and gods are enemies of the soul, because that's fixed, stable. And this is a problem which is running all through. Because
I was just crucified.
Why?
So that the matter could become spirit and I wouldn't have to speculate.
No, the first sentence of the mother says aspiration and response. So two forces from below.
That's yoga. That's yoga.
But yoga is.
No, yoga is individual.
Of course, individual and universe. They're both. And simply what happened in 69, this opening.
56.
69.
Oh, 69, right.
69, when it was.
Yeah, okay, but what happened in 69 was her physical reception.
Exactly. Yeah. But it was objective.
Her physical...
Yes, but...
Not her objective physical reception.
But through her, we also perceive. This. She's a mediatrix. She's a unique person who...
Through her, you perceived what? In 1969?
recall.
Okay, but you didn't perceive what she perceived, presumably.
It's not necessary.
I know one person...
See, it is problem how to respond, not how do you in sense
how you are open.
Yeah, exactly. This problem. Because what is your name?
The energy, I mean, in the very, very first day that we came here, I raised the question, is the subtle energy in the atmosphere and what we read in Sri Aurobindo's and the Mother's writing enough? Or is something more required?
Of course there's something more required.
And the Course in Evolution has the goal to help us put together for ourselves what it takes to become a participant in the evolutionary process. A participant, an active participant, which would be the something else. Between just experiencing the mother's force and reading about her experience, there is something else which could happen. We could become evolutionary beings. And then we went into exactly what that would mean. It would mean certain specific shifts in consciousness that would enable us to perceive and feel and see and act in a way that Sri Aurobindo describes. So, to get away from his descriptions and to enter into that process itself is at least a possibility that can be defined. And there are problems in the philosophy of evolution that could be solved if we did that. They are not solved just because we say that it's a possibility to do that. So that's pretty much everything I wanted to say.
But the door is open. All are invited.
No doubt. Tatsat.